Hi, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, the 17th of June, 1996. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Barbara Rossing. She will be continuing her Bible study. Today's session is number 6 and is titled Feeling Homeless, 1 Peter for Exiles and Aliens. Let's listen in.
Welcome, everyone. It's great to see new faces. I taught also last week on the book of Revelation, and it's great to see new people as we launch into 1 Peter this week. My name is Barbara Rossing. I'm a professor at the Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago, which is one of the ELCA seminaries. And this is the first of a three-part series this week on 1 Peter. And today's topic is feeling homeless, feeling like an exile, and the sense of exile in 1 Peter. I want to start with a prayer. This is Psalm 137. I think it's a psalm that really fits this situation of being exiled. And I want to read a version of it written by a Namibian who is a pastor named Zephaniah Kamita, and he wrote this book, Why, O Lord, Psalms and Sermons from Namibia. He wrote this before Namibia was independent from South Africa, so he wrote out of a real feeling of exile. Now, I think he's even a member of the government. Do you know, Tom?
Yeah, he's the deputy minister of parliament.
Yeah, he's wonderful. He's been up here at Holden Village. We have tapes of Zephaniah Kamita speaking up here at Holden. He was here in 1977. I happened to be a waiter. I felt really privileged to hear him. But anyway, he's got these wonderful sort of contemporary interpretations of the Psalms out of the Namibian situation. And this is a really, this one really speaks to this sense of exile. By the rivers of foreign countries, we sat down as refugees. There we wept when we remembered the land of our birth. We stopped singing our beloved songs of liberation. Those who are helping our enemies wanted us to sing. They wanted us to entertain them. Sing us a song about the land from where you fled. How can they expect us to entertain them with our suffering and tears? May I never turn our struggle for freedom and peace into entertainment for those who are friends of our enemies. May I never be able to sing again if I do not remember you, if I do not think of you, O country of my birth. Zephaniah Kamita actually wasn't an exile from Namibia, but many, many people were in the days of waiting for independence from South Africa. And maybe you even met some of them, Namibian exiles, or maybe you know other exiles from other countries. There are so many exiles or aliens in our world, millions, especially in Africa. It's estimated, I think, that 30% of the people in Africa are now refugees, living not in the land of their birth and hoping, longing to go back. It's that sense of exile that 1 Peter serves to heighten and identify for Christians, and I think is really important. We will see that as a theme running through this letter, that it's written to aliens, and it's written out of a sense of alienation to speak to those who feel alien and homeless. Who, many of whom probably are true aliens living in Turkey or Asia Minor, in these provinces of Asia, but having no rights as citizens. He addresses them as aliens and exiles. First, let me just say a little bit of background about 1 Peter. Few of us, I think, have taken very much time to study 1 Peter. I don't know, have any of you ever done Bible studies on 1 Peter? I don't think it's a widely studied book right now, and certainly among scholars, it's not one of the main books that gets a lot of attention right now. And I have mixed feelings about 1 Peter. I can just say I struggle with this book. There's much that I love about it, but there's also much that I find troublesome, and I'll especially look at some of that on Wednesday when we talk about the ethics of 1 Peter, because it's very much a conservative sort of ethics that is the ethics of conformity and submission to the government in a difficult situation. I should just say, though, that 1 Peter has been in the past, and I think deserves to be again, highly regarded. Martin Luther regarded it as one of the most important books of the New Testament. I'll just read here from his preface to the books of the New Testament in volume 35 of Luther's works. If you're interested ever, you can see all his prefaces to all the New Testament books. The ones that I read last week, the prefaces to Revelation, are also found in here, where he tells you basically his opinion about each book as a way of introducing it. Which are the true and noblest books of the New Testament? John's Gospel and St. Paul's epistles, especially that to the Romans, and St. Peter's first epistle are the true kernel and marrow of all the books. They ought properly to be the foremost books, and it would be advisable for every Christian to read them first and most, by daily reading to make them as much your own as your daily bread. And then he concludes, in a word, St. John's Gospel, St. Paul's epistles, especially Romans, Galatians, and Ephesians, and St. Peter's first epistles are the books that show you Christ and teach you all that is necessary for salvation, for you to know, even if you were never to see or hear any other book or doctrine. And then he goes on to say, therefore, St. James's epistle is really an epistle of straw compared to these others. So this is where he makes his famous statement about James being the epistle of straw. And he's comparing it specifically to the ones he holds in high regards, which are John's Gospel, most of all, Paul's epistles, and 1 Peter. Luther put 1 Peter right up there with those other books. So it's interesting kind of how it's fallen from that privileged status to not being particularly studied. But I think it's definitely important to study 1 Peter. Last week I did 5 Bible studies on the book of Revelation. I don't know if any of you were here, probably not. But 1 Peter is addressed to very much the same situation. The same provinces of Asia, a little more all-encompassing. Revelation was addressed to communities more towards the coast, the western coast of Turkey. But 1 Peter is written also to communities, Christian communities in Asia Minor, specifically named, we'll see. And about the same time period, certainly after the fall of Jerusalem, so after 70 AD. You can never know exactly when to date these books. They don't give their date. But probably in the 80s, in Turkey, and Revelation was maybe written in the 90s in Turkey, but very much the same time period, basically. Same situation, same churches, same communities, but a completely different kind of response to that situation. So both letters we see reflected the situation of Christians as marginalized, almost persecuted. We have to talk about whether it was actual persecution or whatever, but certainly feeling a sense of marginalization from the government and from their neighbors. They had a lot of hostile neighbors. But both of them respond quite differently. Revelation responds to that situation with an ethics of resistance. Resist the government. Do not worship the beast. Stand strong. Come out of Babylon, O my people. And it's this sense of exodus and resistance and not conforming, whereas 1 Peter responds to the identical situation with quite a different ethics, one of conformity, of fitting in, of sort of survival, of fit in, be exemplary in this situation, in this social context that is trying to persecute you. For by your example, you will show your loyalty and your Christian faith. So it's a good example, I think, to lay these two books alongside each other, because we can see then how Christians don't always respond to the same ethical dilemma or the same situation in identical ways. There are different strategies of how to be an ethical Christian in the same context, and 1 Peter and Revelation are a very good example of that. Okay, today then, in the first session, I want to focus on this feeling of homelessness or exile that runs so strongly through 1 Peter. A deep, deep sense of alienation that's expressed right in the first verse of the book and then continues throughout. The tension between exile and being an alien, and then God's sense of giving us a home, being at home in the gospel, but aliens in our culture. And not being a people. First Peter has this wonderful verse of, once you were not my people, but now you are my people. And clearly it's written to people who were outcasts in society and who have now been gathered into a home. It's going to set the word, I put on here the Greek word par oikos, which is the word for alien. And it's going to set against that the word for home, which is just plain oikos. Oikos by itself means home or house. And very much 1 Peter is a book about being at home in God and finding a sense of home in God. And it's written to those who are par oikos, which is a technical term, a legal term of a social status that's pretty low in society, of having very few rights, which is to be like a resident alien in a country that isn't your country. Now, the question, of course, with this term, par oikos, is whether it's literal par oikos, whether it's addressed to people who actually are resident aliens in this country, in those provinces of Turkey, or whether it's this kind of metaphorical sense of all Christians being aliens because our true home is in heaven with God. And certainly that's a dilemma. We saw it last week in the book of Revelation. Which of the images do you read literally and which do you read figuratively or metaphorically? I mean, where it's a question in all the books of the New Testament. Kinship language is another example. Whenever Paul says brothers and sisters, is he ever talking about literal kinship? I mean, is he ever addressing literal sisters and brothers, or is it all the kinship that's metaphorical that is created in Jesus Christ? Scholars always have to struggle with wondering about that. One interpretation I've read, and same with slavery language, is when he says, I am a slave of Christ, does he literally mean slavery? Is he ever speaking literally to slaves, or is that a kind of metaphorical term too? And this is a big issue, for example, with Philemon, Paul's little letter to Philemon, because the question is it about an escaped slave, a literal slave who's now being returned as a metaphorical brother to his owner, or is it about, and this is another spin that can be put on Philemon, that it's metaphorical slave, but true kinship. It's two brothers who didn't get along, two blood brothers who didn't get along, and it's a different way of reading the languages. But anyway, you always have to struggle with this with books of the New Testament, is what is it that we read literally and what do we read metaphorically? And this exile imagery of 1 Peter is an example. Now, the trend, I would say, among modern scholars now is to read this image more literally than people had in the past. Not so much this, I'm a sojourn here on earth seeking my heavenly home, but to see it actually addressed to a whole stratum of society living in Asia Minor who had few, if any, rights and who were being treated by their neighbors as aliens and who were, in fact, not citizens but aliens in that country. One of the most recent commentaries, for example, by a guy named John Eliot, who's sort of Mr. First Peter, is called A Home for the Homeless. And he very much argues, on the basis of many other ancient texts, that this language is to be understood literally, that it's addressed to Christians who were in the bottom or near bottom tier of this society and who were, in fact, outcasts and aliens legally and socially in that culture. And I think we really need to remember that dimension now for us as well. Not too many of us in this room probably are aliens, literally. I mean, I don't know how many of you have to go to the police station every year to register as a registered alien or whatever you have to do in this country when you're not a citizen. A somewhat humiliating experience. And we have in our country many refugees and aliens, both legal and illegal. But not too many of us are literally that right now, although perhaps you've experienced that feeling when you've been in another country and felt so lost and homeless. I think the book of 1 Peter does speak to each one of us, and so we can talk about that figurative sense of homelessness also, where in a way we, all of us as Christians, are strangers in this culture that is so material and commercial, and we often feel like strangers even in our own congregations. For example, we talked at the first session about that. When you raise issues and nobody else seems to be concerned in your congregation about the same thing, that's a very lonely feeling. But this is all a kind of more metaphorical sense of alienation. And I think we can read it at all these levels, the existential alienation that we often feel as Christians, provided we keep in mind the literal sense as well, that there are, that we are living in a world of many, many refugees, people with no rights, and that this, we need to overhear how this book speaks to them as well, and how it spoke to literal aliens in the first century who were not granted citizenship rights and who were outcasts in that society. Okay, why don't we take a look at a few passages here, and you'll see how this theme plays out somewhat in 1 Peter. Let's just start with the first two verses, in fact. If somebody would be willing to read chapter 1, 1 to 2.
Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, the exiles of the dispersion in Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia, who have been chosen and destined by God the Father and sanctified by the Spirit to be obedient to Jesus Christ and to be sprinkled with his blood, may grace and peace be yours in abundance.
Okay. So this is this begins, as do all ancient letters, with a set format. This is very much an epistle, a letter that's written from a specific person in Rome, Peter, to specific communities in Asia. And they always start their letters more like our memos, where they no, actually, we do our memos to first and then from second. But anyway, they start their memos as from Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to the exiles. And then it's interesting here, it's the literally the Greek word here is the exiles of the diaspora. So it's too bad, I think, that the English uses dispersion, because we, you're familiar with the term diaspora, right? This is the significant segment of the Jewish population that after the exile into Babylon in 587 BC, not everybody came back to Palestine, to Israel, after that. And so many Jewish people had by that time settled in Babylon and many in Egypt, a large population in Egypt, some in Rome, all over the Greco-Roman Empire then, Jewish people were scattered. And this is the diaspora. Many of them prospered. Some studies indicate that diaspora Jews were better off economically than the Jews in Israel, but they always lived a somewhat fragile existence because they never knew when the government would turn against them or when their neighbors would. It's not always official persecution, but it could be your neighbors as well. But they, many of them had a very good existence living in these different countries, and they are the diaspora. So what Peter is doing here is applying that term now to Christians who are living in Asia, in Turkey. And he's giving them, applying to them, this sense of being a diaspora, of living this kind of out on the margin sort of existence here. And he's calling them both exiles and diaspora here. So he's definitely, from the very beginning of this epistle, conveying on his readers, or identifying their situation anyway, as one of exile and diaspora in these provinces of Asia. Bithynia, one of the ones that's named, for example, is, well, actually not too many of you were here last week. I'll have to bring in this letter again this week. But we have one sort of independent piece of evidence, a little bit of evidence about what the situation was for Christians in Bithynia a few years later, maybe 30 years later, when the governor of that province, Pliny, wrote to the Emperor Trajan with asking advice about what to do about the Christians and how to deal with them, because there were very many Christians in Bithynia, and he was feeling acutely that not enough people were visiting the pagan temples anymore or buying the meat that had been sacrificed in the meat market. So he writes to the emperor for advice, and it does sound like it was a situation then becoming pretty difficult for Christians, and that's one of the specific provinces named here. So certainly Christianity was really starting to spread in Asia at this time, and there was then some backlash from the empire against these Christians and from their neighbors as well, and they certainly would have been in a marginalized situation socially. So Peter writes to them as exiles in a diaspora, and then writes about how they're chosen by God. Why don't we look at a couple other passages, and you can see this exile theme playing out again. Further on in chapter 1, let's look at 13 through 17. And already here, you'll be able to see in these passages how his ethics, he addresses them as aliens and exiles, and then he calls them to an ethics that is fitting into society. We'll talk about that specifically on Wednesday, what it means to conform in 1 Peter and how we can deal with that. If somebody would be really willing to read 1, 13 to 17 here.
Therefore, prepare your minds for action. Discipline yourselves. Set all your hope on the grace that Jesus Christ will bring you when he is revealed. Like obedient children, do not be conformed to the desires that you formerly had in ignorance. Instead, as he who called you is holy, be holy yourselves in all your conduct. For it is written, you shall be holy, for I am holy. If you invoke as Father the one who judges all people impartially according to their deeds, live in reverent fear during the time of your exile.
And that last word there, during the time of your exile, is again this word, par oikos here, the exile that you're living in. So he addresses them in that situation of homelessness or being aliens and tells them to conduct themselves according to that. Now, I want to hear from you all today about how you then hear the sense of homelessness and alienation. I should confess that last week I did most of the presenting in the Bible study sessions on the book of Revelation. This week it's sort of a work in progress. I'm going to be speaking at the Global Mission event in Spokane on 1 Peter next week. I don't know if any of you are going to it. And I've got the talks sort of framed out biblically, but I'm wanting more stories from people about feeling homeless or about working with aliens. Many of you probably have very interesting work that you've done or have stories to tell. And I'm even going to take notes, if that's okay with you, during the discussion to put some flesh on these talks. I would like this week to be more like our text studies are at Holden, where each Saturday you gather with the preacher for Sunday and really shape the sermon in terms of the discussion, how you respond to the biblical texts. And if we can almost be a text study group this week, it'll be very helpful to me. Just to get some Old Testament background first, though, I would invite you to pick one of these five passages here, these ones, where the word par oikos, obviously the Old Testament is written in Hebrew, not Greek, but when it got translated into Greek in what's called the Septuagint, par oikos is the word that is used in a number of these Old Testament passages. So this is how we can start to see the thread of this word as it comes into the New Testament, because Peter is writing, drawing on a whole sort of tablet of imagery and stories that people knew and that he could appeal to. And it's rich, rich Old Testament stories of exile and alienation. And you'll see in all of these that it's very much meant literally, that these are people. These passages are about Israelites in exile, and this one is about how to treat the aliens in your own, in Israel. So pick any one of these on the list. I think these are about Abraham in exile here. This one is about Moses. This is about Israel, and these are aliens in Israel. And if we could just get some of these read to sort of frame how we talk about exiles and aliens in 1 Peter. And I only put the specific verse number on here that actually has the word, but back up a little bit to start the sort of passage to set the context. I think this one, for example, would start with verse 10. Genesis 12, 10 through 12. Does anybody have that?
Now there was a famine in the land, so Abram went down to Egypt to reside there as an alien, for the famine was severe in the land. When he was about to enter Egypt.
Okay, that's about Sarah. Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, then he passes off his wife as his sister. As a strategy for survival. I mean, it's the same idea that when you're an alien, you don't have a lot of power. And so you do what you have to survive. But this is typical of how the word is used in the Old Testament. It's literally being an exile in not your own country. Abraham had to go to Egypt because there was a famine. Thank you. and he was an exile or alien. Anybody have one of these other ones?
Genesis 15.
Okay.
As the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and a deep and terrifying darkness descended upon him. Then the Lord said to Abram, "Know this for certain, that your offspring shall be aliens in a land that is not theirs, and shall be slaves there, and they shall be oppressed for 400 years.
So it's not a good thing to be in exile and be an alien. It's sort of the equivalent of being a slave in that passage. There are tons of Old Testament references. I just picked a few of these out. Does anybody have one of the other ones?
I have this Exodus one where Moses has left Egypt and is married Zipporah. He gave Moses his daughter Zipporah in marriage. She bore a son, and he named him Gershon, for he said, "I have been an alien residing in a foreign land."
Okay. And remember, Moses had to flee to that foreign land, right? Why did Moses go there? Yeah, Moses had murdered somebody and he had to flee, and now he names his child. I mean, he was well received by the Midianites, and it's a good thing. But he names his child after the sense of being an alien or exile in the wrong country. I mean, it's when you're not at home in your country that you use this term, par oikos. Anybody have any of the other ones?
The other Exodus. The instructions for observing the Passover.
Oh yeah, this is a sad one.
This is funny. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "This is the ordinance for the Passover. No foreigner shall eat of it, but any slave who has been purchased may eat of it after he has been circumcised. No bound or hired servant may eat of it." And then it goes on and says more of the same.
So if for Jewish people, if the Passover is the meal of identity, that means you're in the family of God, the community of God, in the sense that baptism is for Christians, and Dan Erlander is doing wonderful sessions this week on baptism, just think of how this text would be heard by those who are aliens, that you can't eat of the Passover. You know, Moses trying to decide here, who gets to eat the Passover and who doesn't? And the alien does not. Now, I should say there are certainly other wonderful Old Testament passages about care for the alien, one of those is still coming up here. Remembering that you were aliens also in Egypt is often a refrain that tells the Israelites not to treat aliens badly amongst them, but they cannot eat of the Passover. I mean, there's still the sense, even though you treat aliens fairly, they aren't in. They're exiles. Does anybody have a second one?
You shall not abhor any of the Edomites, for they are your kin. You shall not abhor any of the Egyptians, because you were an alien residing in their land.
Yeah, this is an example of that. Not to hate the Edomites, or not even to hate the Egyptians, because you were an exile residing there. But it's definitely this literal sense of exile and alienation.
This revised standard uses the word sojourner instead of exile, and I'm getting an entirely different feeling.
Yeah, I was reading Eliot on that this morning. He has a very strong case where he argues, that when those words are translated as things like sojourn or pilgrim, sometimes even, or stranger even, that it doesn't have this sort of jarring sense that alien.
I'm just kind of visiting.
Or exile.
Like a tourist.
Because I wanted to, where an exile was an entirely different feeling.
A sojourner would be a tourist or a visitor. No, definitely the word par oikos, it's not voluntary. I mean, you're there. Well, it's not like you were brought there, but it is a sense of being clashing with the culture and not having rights. Yeah, it's more like these Old Testament passages and less this sense of tourist or visiting. Yeah, I know, it's interesting. Well, then you're catching this idea that Eliot really brings forward in this commentary. He says that too often 1 Peter has been read in more this sort of sojourn sense or spiritual sense, and we too often forget that it's grounded in a very real social or political reality of people who were far away from their homeland and longing for it, just like Kmita writes there about. And how can we sing the Lord's song in a strange land, this kind of anguish of not being at home? I should say that there are a couple passages in the Old Testament where the par oikos is used in a more metaphorical sense. Not many, but a few. For example, it's sometimes used for a sense of humility. King David, for example, one time is praying to God, and he prays, O Lord, we are all par oikos before you. We live as par oikos, like our fathers. So obviously, King David was never an alien. I mean, he was the king. But he prays as, oh Lord, we are all before you, we are all aliens or sojourners. So it's this more metaphorical use. But overall, it's very much in the Old Testament, the literal sense of when you're in somebody else's country, mostly involuntarily, if you had to go there because of famine or whatever, then you're a par oikos. So how does that sound for you? I mean, when have you felt homeless, or what situations have you worked in? We talked at the first session, actually, Dave, you weren't here, but about yours and Maria's ministry with seafarers, these people that spend years of their lives on ships and never get to see their families, and how difficult it must be to be an alien or an exile. And how then you hear something like 1 Peter speaking right to you. Another group that has often, let's look at one more passage that has this sense of alienation. You can see the whole thing. Chapter 2, if somebody would read verses 9 through 12. My gay and lesbian friends tell me that this sense of once you were not a people, but now you are a people, very much speaks to them as outcasts too often in society. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have this sense of once you were out, you couldn't eat the Passover, whatever, once you were that far out of the community, but now you've been brought in. And that this in-out stuff is very powerful as it speaks to exiled groups, even within our society. Would someone read 9 through 12? In chapter 2.
But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's own people, in order that you may proclaim the mighty acts of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Beloved, I urge you as aliens and exiles to abstain from the desires of the flesh that wage war against the soul. Conduct yourselves honorably among the Gentiles, so that though they malign you as evildoers, they may see your honorable deeds and glorify God when he comes to judge.
Yeah, already you can see in this passage, and if we went on, you'd see how it's be subject to every human institution, how the ethics that plays out here for 1 Peter is one of conformity and submission. But he's definitely addressing them in verse 11 as aliens and exiles, and he wants them to understand their ethical response out of that location, that social location of being an exile or an alien. Par oikos, people without a home, and then what he's going to do is show how in Christ they find a home. The homeless finds a home, basically, as Eliot says in his title here. Oikos and par oikos are played off against each other in this book. So, I want to hear your stories about being par oikos, or how you hear this literally or metaphorically, or who it makes you think of, Anne?
We had an experience with two Eritrean refugees that our church resettled, and it kind of was maybe a picture of the different ways you can react to being an alien. They both had been in Sudan for 3 years in a refugee camp, and they came to the United States. They both were young men in their 20s. And one of them came fairly directly to the Sudan from his family, fled just before he was going to be inducted into the military. And when he arrived, he had very good English skills and seemed to be the person who was really going to thrive. And the other one had gone to war at age 13 and had decided to flee to Sudan after many years of figuring out that he wasn't sure that peace would come when peace came, because there were divisions within the rebel army. And the thing that was very interesting was that the young man who seemed to be so much more, had better English skills and more coping skills, rapidly deteriorated into a profound depression and ended up, the last I knew of him, he was in a group home in the Twin Cities for people who were mentally ill. And the young man who was much more, you know, had left home at age 13, had, I should say, the other man had family at home, where the young man who had been away from his home since he was 13 became very acclimated to the United States, got very involved in soccer, drives cab in the Twin Cities, and keeps in touch regularly, and seems to just, and it was, I guess when you were talking about it, I just thought, you know, there really are pictures of the different forces that are there. I mean, there's a sadness about Tommy, who has totally become an American because in some ways he has none of the links back. He gave up totally on what he left behind. Ermit Hanny, you know, his sorrow for what he left was so great it destroyed him. And so it sort of, when I think about it, you know, it shows the play of all the things. One, of the turning to the new life completely and thriving in that, but not having the past. And the other being so rooted in the past that
you fall
the profound sadness takes over.
Thanks. Others?
I grew up in Finland, and I was 22 when I left, met my former husband in Germany, and I've been here for 25 years, and single 8 years of those, the last 8 years. And I do have a deep struggle because I'm a Finnish citizen, and I have a struggle of whether to become an American citizen. I don't see myself moving back, yet I have children here. I've gone to school here. I feel very much part of the culture. I like living here in the Northwest. And I've created a life for myself to where I can visit my family in Finland once a year. But there is a deep struggle. I came voluntarily. I wanted to come. I'm fine with that. But there's a struggle of having family there and roots there. And I don't want to give it up. And yet, I'm not going back. So I have a family there, I have a family here. I know I'll live here, and I'm working through this process of whether to become an American because I can't vote. I don't feel adult, in a sense. And I have a very good life, and but it's possibly the ultimate commitment of saying that I guess I don't want to give up something, and I'm not sure that I have to give up something. But also contributing more as a citizen. So I'm working on it, but it's a very deep-seated feeling. I can't describe that. You kind of understand. I'm not impressed, but I have a very good life. But I think I struggle.
Others on how you connected with any of these texts?
Well, my son is working with Hispanic refugees in the Skagit Valley, and also as chaplain at the jail in Mount Vernon. And they get picked up for every little thing, even if they look Hispanic, driving along the highway. And, you know, they come up here to work, people hire them here. And because nobody else will do the work that they do, he's trying to start Bible studies, and he really is hearing stories of alienation and even no rights.
Yeah, and we live in a country that is cracking down more and more now on aliens, and that's the sense of our country. Not this, remember that you were very recently aliens yourself, but yeah, that's great that he does that. You can just, I can't see you people developing. Yes, Ingrid.
Okay. Well, it strikes me that every time anybody comes to Holden Village, they feel this way to some extent. Because Holden Village has changed, and they have changed. And there's some alienation and some fear that you won't fit into community. And I just read an interesting study recently about cities, about our cities, that say that people rate their neighborhoods much, much, much higher, with no regard to the financial wealth of the neighborhood, if they're involved in their church and in their community, if they're involved in community organizations, if they know their neighbors, if they're part of a community, they don't feel alienated. But if, even if they're in a sort of middle-class or wealthy urban neighborhood, they feel alienated and fearful in it if they don't know their neighbors and if they don't belong to a church.
Huh.
So it's not just, I mean, I think this applies to all of us. We yeah. all, I mean, going to kindergarten, going to school, we all feel this terror of not being part of and not being loved and not being accepted by the others.
Yeah, no, it's really true. And there's nowhere lonelier sort of than Holden. There's nowhere you can feel more included than Holden Village, at least for me. But no, you can also be lonely here, too, and feel so alien. It's just that paradox. I mean, I think that's why First Peter does continue to speak to all of us, because at a deep, deep existential level, many of us carry this sort of deep sense of homelessness or wanting a home, wanting so much to find a home in God or in somewhere, that's how the epistle speaks of it.
Well, because my historical work is about immigrants, you know, I think about those 19th century people and all the things that would make them feel psychologically the sense of dislocation. Even as they made a kind of commitment that in the 20th century we don't have to make, because you can go home once a year, but when people would leave Norway, their families would hold a funeral, because they knew they'd never see
them again. Funeral?
Mm-hmm. Wow. They knew they'd never see them again. Once you took that boat, you know, then there were people who would just say, and there were people who returned, and we don't hear much about that, but...
Return for good.
Yeah, who would come over and didn't work, and they'd go back to that old country, but... Many people would say, frankly, they didn't want to get back on that ship. You know, it was months coming, sick and everything. But it's interesting the things that they'll say in their letters that will trigger that. One that you read in Moberg's trilogy about Swedish immigrants is the longing for the long summer evenings. And the light, you know, that light. Yeah, exactly. You know, and so that there are these natural parts of the natural world that will trigger a sense of being out of place. Or just, you know, I have on my wall at Holden a poster of a prairie horizon, because the opposite of Barrett in Rolvag's trilogy, I start feeling real claustrophobic in this valley. I want to see a long way. So those natural things as well as legal or relational things that will trigger a sense of feeling very dislocated, even if you did it on purpose. And that maybe is the place where the spiritual message becomes important to us, that you choose, as Dan Ullender has said, to be odd, but it feels odd to be odd.
When I ask my grown kids where their home is, we have three different states, three different births or adoptions, and they're not sure where their home is until they say it's wherever you're living, I guess, is my
home. Oh, that's sweet, yeah.
But the point is that, and Robert Jensen wrote an article a few years ago saying, has America lost its story in the sense of a narrative? And people, you know, one thing that we, in dislocating ourselves in this culture, is that maybe this part of belonging, in the sense of being not an alien, is to have a story and what you tell yourself about who you are. And that has a lot to do with place. Mm-hmm. And when place is not there, and what Ingrid was talking about in terms of neighborhood, in spite of the affluence, that the power of neighborhood and the power of community is a comic, is a story, a self-understanding of who we are. And it has a lot to do with place. We've learned that, I think, from Native American and others. And I think people struggle now to try to form their story as to who they are and what their narrative is. Even as we sit at the table and say, where are you from? And people hesitate and say, well, I used to live and I was originally born and whatever. And what is our story?
That's this sense of this line, once you were no people, but now you are God's people. I mean, to be no people means you don't have a story.
Right.
You don't have a history and a home. Yeah. Huh? You don't have to wait for me to call on you. Actually, you can just jump in. I see. Okay, here's two.
Mary's church burned down a week before Christmas, a big old central Minneapolis Norwegian church. And it was interesting to me as I went to a meeting right after that church burned down, is that it was some of the Liberian refugees in that church that sort of emerged to the forefront and were encouraging, and that the church burning down became the connecting point for them to really move into that congregation, because being homeless was their life. And now they, it seemed to me like they were feeling more a part of that community. So that the church burning down created community, and then they felt now that they had something maybe to contribute or to teach the rest of the members. And we're very confident that the church would go on. And I don't know, that church seems to me to be more of a community having lost their church building.
I've been working now for the last several years with a people that I've come to think of exile, and that's the Native American people, especially in Montana. I've been working with the people themselves, educators, but then more specifically with that, the literature. And to hear the people's stories, what we have, those of us who maybe are interested in American Indian literature or story, have a romanticized, like the romanticized picture, and as he was just mentioning this sense of place, and we might feel good about that, thinking about them in history. But the truth is that over the last 100-150 years, they have, most of them have been exiles. There is in every on every reservation 5 generations of boarding school exiles. And I was just looking at this Exodus 1, 12:43-45. And the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, this is the ordinance of the Passover. No foreigner shall eat of it. That when they were removed from the ceremony and the spiritual experience and the place and taken away from home for as long as 3 years, and absolutely told that they couldn't really participate. There is one woman, Gertrude Bonin, who was writing in 1900, could not participate in the ceremony or the activity of citizenship even. So they were cut off and asked to assimilate without giving them the extra kind of things that they might move into. And today what you have are contemporary writers who are writing about that experience of what it feels like to live between two worlds. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the literature and the poetry then has the word remember, remember, remember. The Christian churches that were the most the strongest and the most successful are the ones, there was one in South Dakota in particular on the Yankton Reservation, were successful because they did not forbid them to use their other language. And those of us who work with Native people and see the destruction of a culture and of a society on the reservations where there's a lot of problem, you can kind of look. It's not an excuse, but it's an explanation to look at 5 generations of children removed from the homes where they never got to learn parenting skills or anything like that. And the ones that are now are the happiest and most successful are the ones that are taking their traditional culture and looking. There are a lot of Christians who have not let go of their traditional culture. There are in Montana, there is only one reservation where the people are in the home place, this sense of place, and that's the Crow people, because they did maybe what the First Peter did. They worked with the whites. The rest all were against them, but they worked with the whites, and so they were able to maintain and establish their home. Otherwise, the rest are all exiles in the places they're left.
And we talked at the first, thanks for that, about how there are different strategies that you apply in different situations. Maybe that was the smartest strategy to sort of go along with the empire for the sake of survival, as Abraham decided to do this, passing his wife off as his sister to survive kind of thing, and that there's different strategies of responses, and all of them, though, involve maintaining a sense of peoplehood, of being, you can't be no people and survive. If you look at those Hosea texts, it's really pretty awful there where Hosea names his child Lo Ami, not is Lo, and Ami is people, not my people, but then later comes through with a sense of being a people. What First Peter does is use wonderful images to construct a sense of peoplehood, of oikos, to give people a home, literally. The living stones image is just so beautiful. Come to Jesus, that living stone, and yourselves be living stones built up into a household of faith. This is one of First Peter's most beautiful images. Obviously metaphorical. I mean, we know that there aren't living stones, and we're not living stones, and neither is Jesus. But it's this beautiful image of being stones built up then into a house together, where we're all part of living stones as is Jesus. Another one he uses is what we're going to look at tomorrow, of being born again, where God actually births us again, First Peter says, and gives us then a name and an identity, a family, a sense of kinship, because the one who gives you birth is your parent. I say parent because it's imagery that can be either masculine or feminine to birth someone. And so I think there's an interesting gender kind of switching that goes on here in First Peter, but of this idea of God giving us birth to the alien and giving us an identity, then a family. First Peter is very good at constructing this sense of identity for people who obviously were feeling very alienated and exiled in a strange land. But I think it's working always with this sense of one foot in each of two realms and not really knowing where you exactly belong. Some studies have said that missionary kids, for example, really struggle with that. They grew up their whole life in Africa, but they're also U.S. citizens. You know, how do they survive? They seem to, some studies say, either thrive or really go into depression, as you were saying. I mean, that it's really hard to live not knowing where your exact home is and where you fit in. And First Peter is responding then to that situation. For any of you who have ever felt like you haven't belonged or can't find your home, this is a letter for you. Uh-huh.
So in essence, we're all aliens, all of us. It's like a human condition. Because when you get to the root of who we are, not just the community or our place, we often feel that there may not be very many people who understand our thoughts, understand what we're really thinking, you know, can truly listen to who we are as a person. And so that's an alienation, actually, at the core of who we are as an individual. So without being rooted in Christ, we are totally, as a human, alienated.
Yeah, I think it's very appropriate for us to read First Peter in that sort of deep existential sense, because most of us have that sense somewhere in ourselves that only baptism or only being claimed by God can speak to, and it's this deep sort of hole. So I think exactly what you say is right, provided we don't forget the literal. I mean, let's read it at the same time metaphorically in this figurative sense of being, or existentially being an alien, but don't forget the literal sense also that we live in a world of, I think, almost a billion refugees now, or people who literally, not in a metaphorical sense, but literally, don't have a home. Think of the homeless people in our cities. These are the literal par oikos. So read it also with overhearing how it speaks to them, and in because many people do live in situations of terrible political alienation and no home, literally. Mm-hmm. And we need to hear how First Peter reads for them as well, and take it as a challenge to all of us. But I think both levels at once. David?
Uh-huh. Yeah, speaking to that, it's normal, and part of Bible study is we relate to it as we can. But there's also a danger here. I want to highlight two aspects that come out of my experience, of, as you referred to, working with seafarers. One is choice. Dan, you referred to the fact whether you choose to become an exile or not really does make a difference. I notice it among the people who work on ships who come from societies where they really don't have a choice about whether or not to go to sea. And secondly is the treatment you receive from the host society. It's one thing to be at Holden and not feel like I'm being included or being affirmed. It's another thing to actually be treated in a hostile manner. I'll give you an example. Seafarers, ever since they came back from the Crusades, have had the rights to be treated as local citizens in the ports where they call. Something about somebody who came back from the Crusades was horrified at the fact that people who were rowing the ships that carried his troops could be dumped when they got sick, could they just be dumped in port and left to die. And so ever since then, seafarers have had the right in the ports where they work to receive access to the local court structure. And the freshman Republicans in Congress last year passed a bill that would strip foreign seamen from access to U.S. courts. And that went through no problem because everybody said, well, they're foreigners. They can sue in Guatemala if they have a problem against the Greek-registered ship that hasn't paid them for 6 months. Now, that's just out of the question. They don't, and the Senate hasn't passed it yet, so it's stuck in a conference committee right now. But it is very likely that we, now, and if you're a seaman, imagine the difference between not feeling affirmed and actually being treated in a hostile manner, in a threatened manner, or choosing to move around a lot and therefore not have a home versus being forced to for your basic livelihood.
No, I agree. I think it's really important to distinguish.
I see another way we've made a class of exiles among us with mentally ill, at least in this state, half of an idea got. There's an idea to close down the big mental institutions and then to make smaller, kind of more neighborhood-based places. Well, the big institutions got closed, but the smaller ones never got built. And I remember going from place to place with my friend Melanie, who was diagnosed as borderline personality and something else. And she would have a certain number of days that she was allowed to be in a mental institution. There's no choice here. And talk about hostility. Then when her 10 days in this pretty nice facility ran out, she'd be moved to the next facility, which would be not so good, until finally she was moved to Western State. Melanie carries in her pocket this passage, "Once I was no person, now I am a person." And she would pull it out and look at it when she would be at Western State with no bed, sleeping on the floor in front of a cough dispenser. They wouldn't call her by her name. She had her own story. She couldn't remember her own story. Do you know? I mean, she was such an exile, such an alien in her own life, and and what do we do? I think we've created this in part, helped create this class of exiles among us. But this is First Peter's what she carries as a reminder when she's treated inhumanely, locked in places where only her pastor, who's wearing a clerical collar, can get in, and they have to check the bread and wine before I bring it into the room. Huh. You know, people sniffing it at the door. So real hostility. So she would just read this over, and that sometimes was her mantra. I am a person.
Wow. Well, thank you, everybody. You guys have amazing stories in this room. I do have to end because, of course, we can't be late for a coffee break. But first, I want to have us sing a song. Each day this week, I think we can sing together. And Tom has agreed to play number 734 in With One Voice. I maybe didn't bring enough copies, so you probably have to share. Who doesn't have one anywhere near you? And maybe we can get the copies out. We'll just sing one verse. Oh, yeah, good. You play the background this time. If any of you see
Bountiful?
Yeah.
This is the song. It's about an old woman who has to go to the city to live with her son because she's obviously getting Alzheimer's or something. And all she wants to do is go home to her town, which is called Bountiful. And she finally escapes and gets on the Greyhound and tries to go to Bountiful. And she's hearing this song, Come Home, Come Home. I think this is the theme of 1 Peter that we all hear. God calling to us, come home, and it's really wonderful with Jesus. Okay.
Thanks. Thanks, Tom.